Greeting and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forums and your host for today. We welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce this evening's speaker, Nathaniel Popper. Nathaniel Popper is a reporter at the New York Times, where he has covered the intersection of Wall Street and Silicon Valley. Before joining the Times, he worked at the Los Angeles Times and the Forward. Popper grew up in Pittsburgh and graduated from Harvard College. He is the author of Digital Gold, a bestseller on the history of Bitcoin, the digital money and financial technology that is used globally, which he will discuss with you this evening. Without further ado, Nathaniel Popper.
Guess I don't get to use the gavel, so I'll put that over here. Good. Well, thank you guys for all showing up. I am here to talk about Bitcoin, which is one of the most misunderstood, confusing topics around. And for some reason, all of you decided to come out here and hear me do that. So let's give it a swing and see what I can do. It's actually helpful to start just by asking, how many people here own a Bitcoin or own part of a Bitcoin? Interesting. So the left side of the room, we got the rookies over here. And how many people have owned one at some point? Is that number any larger than the number I just got? No. Okay. And how many people aren't entirely sure what Bitcoin is? Okay. Good. Division of the room. Definitely you two guys. Yeah. Okay. So this certainly strikes home the point that there is this incredible range of understanding about Bitcoin. There are people who have dedicated their lives to this, and that's a lot of the people that I write about in this book. And there are people who are sort of baffled by the very basic notion of this. And what I'm hopefully going to do tonight is provide something for everyone. And I generally like to do that by focusing on the stories of the people who helped create Bitcoin. That's the way I like to think about technology. I think it provides insights into where things came from, where they're going. And I want to actually start with the very basics of this system. And I find that even people who know exactly how Bitcoin works often don't know where to start. It's this sort of unwieldy technology with a lot of different elements. And oftentimes when you ask a person who's been working on it for 3 years, what is Bitcoin, you just kind of get silence because they don't know where to begin. So I'm going to try something. Maybe you guys will tell me later if it works. But start with really the most basic building block of this system, which is the Bitcoin address. And a Bitcoin address is generally 34 digits long and looks something like this. This here is actually one of my Bitcoin addresses. And like all Bitcoin addresses, it was generated for free by software that is easily findable on the internet. And anybody can generate as many of these addresses as they want. These addresses, the easiest way to think of it is essentially as an email address, where an email address allows you to send, receive, and hold messages. A Bitcoin address allows you to send, receive, and hold Bitcoins. Unlike a email address, your name is generally not associated with your address. It just looks like this scramble of letters and numbers that's kind of unique scramble. So this address, which I just shared with you, when I took this image of my wallet, Bitcoin wallet, on Saturday, as you can see, there's my address, and it had 0.1 Bitcoins in it. Pretty basic stuff. I mean, part of why I'm hoping to do this is just give a sense that it's not, like, at the base, this complicated thing. It's you have an address, you have money associated with that address. And as you can see, Bitcoins can be broken down into bits. You don't have to buy a whole Bitcoin. You can buy a part of a Bitcoin. You can buy any fraction of a Bitcoin. So the other building block of this system is the private key that is associated with each address. And this is generally around 64 digits. And here, I'm revealing to you, is the private key that goes with the Bitcoin address I just gave you. Just so you know, with this password, you can spend any money that is associated. Good, I see people taking pictures. Very smart. Very smart. This is essentially an email password. That's the easiest way to think of it. You have your email address and your password. Bitcoin, you have your Bitcoin address and your Bitcoin private key. And if you want to send money, all you need is the Bitcoin address of another person. So on Saturday, basic idea here. Private key, you unlock the Bitcoin address, which is what I showed you, and you send money. This is, on Saturday, I used the address that I showed you to buy a copy of my book, which is sold on Overstock. And like everything that Overstock sells, you can buy it for Bitcoin. And my book, you will notice, is $19.82 in dollars. And can everybody, is the lighting such that you can see this? This one's a little fuzzy. I'll explain it. Don't worry. $19.82 in dollars and 0.0848 Bitcoins. And Overstock gave me that Bitcoin address, which is similar to the other Bitcoin address, to send my money to complete this transaction. So I took that address, I put it in my wallet for pay to Overstock, I put in the price of the book, 0.08 Bitcoins, I put in my password, and ta-da, the book was sent, and a new hot-off-the-presses copy of Digital Gold was sent to my house. I hope you'll all do this as soon as you go home. For the folks who were taking pictures of my private key, that particular Bitcoin address is now empty. They'll be sad to know. I used it over the weekend and then cleared the money out of it, although I'm sure there's some backdoor that allows them to steal all my money, and I'll find that out when I go home later tonight. The point of this all is to sort of make clear that at the simplest level, Bitcoin is like email for money. It's a system that allows you to send money to anyone with a Bitcoin address anywhere in the world. But there is one big difference. With an email address, you can look in your inbox and see all the emails you've sent and received, but nobody else can. With Bitcoin, all of the transactions, all of the money going in and out of your wallet, and those of every other address, Bitcoin address, are recorded on a big universal spreadsheet in the sky that everyone can access. And this website here, blockchain.info, is one website, not the only one, where you can get access to this spreadsheet in the sky and see what's happening in Bitcoin land. And what you see here is the latest transactions, all the transactions going in and out of happening in the Bitcoin world in about course of 20 seconds at some one point on Saturday. And you can click on any transaction, so I'm going to click on this transaction, and see that the money is going from that address to that address, and it was split into these amounts, 3.57 Bitcoins, 0.5 Bitcoins. So you can find any transaction that has been made at any point in Bitcoin's history on this spreadsheet. This sort of spreadsheet that I showed you here that shows all the transactions is visible sort of because and due to the fact that it isn't kept, all these transactions, the record of all the transactions that have ever happened, aren't kept by one person or one company. It is kept on lots of computers, sort of like the results that pop up on Google aren't kept in one place. It's sort of distributed. And the public record of what's happened in Bitcoin is known as the blockchain. And it's a chain of all the transactions that have ever happened. And if I search for my address, the one I showed you on this, you can find my address. It's that's my address. You can search for my address. And this is my address on that public blockchain before I bought that book on Saturday. It had 0.1 bitcoins. And here is after I bought the book. I didn't capitalize overstock. I thought it was, that was a mistake, actually. So this is actually the transaction in which I sent $19.70 to them to buy my book. And this is visible to anybody. And this is, you can also search the overstock address. So this is the address that I sent it to. And you can see, here's me sending money to overstock. And then here's what they did after I bought the book. So this public nature of Bitcoin, the way that everything is recorded for everybody to see, is sort of seems like a small tweak on systems that have existed before, like email. But it's actually a very big difference, and we'll get into this. But with previous methods, particularly with money, you always had to have a central authority like a bank that was making sure that you had the money you were trying to spend and that was transferring the money to somebody else and that was updating the records. With Bitcoin, thanks to this public record, everyone is keeping track, and as a result, there's no central authority needed. Two people can meet and exchange money in cyberspace without relying on any other institution other than this network. So, everyone, ordinary folks who haven't learned about Bitcoin, I imagine I've lost you. Everyone else who does know about Bitcoin, you're just bored. So, let's go back to the beginning, to the people who created this, and try to understand why they did it. And that's what my book is about. It's about the people. The person I'm beginning with, if you can see him, his name is Hal Finney. He's kind of fading there. He actually died last year he died of ALS. He's actually was immediately frozen. His body was frozen for future resuscitation, and actually his family doesn't talk about him as necessarily being dead. So he is, that kind of fading quality is sort of suitable for Hal Finney. But this was a math nerd. This guy was a math nerd, but who was also kind of all around, you know, Renaissance man. He liked skiing. He in the 1990s, got involved in a group called the Cypherpunks. And this is kind of the predecessors to the WikiLeaks crowd of today. The Edward Snowden crowd, that cared passionately about privacy. The notion that the government was snooping on everything that we are doing. And the cypherpunks, Hal Finney included, basically wanted to find technological tools to allow people to evade the government's watchful eye. It's interesting, it sort of can seem off to the side, but the main thing that a lot of these folks were trying to achieve was a digital cash. In the old world, these folks realized cash allowed this kind of this immediate transaction. You gave the person the money, and the transaction was over. There was nobody else needed to make that happen. And I think there was this recognition in the cypherpunks, and Hal was very much at the front of this, that when transactions moved to the electronic world, there always needed to be a middleman when you were moving money through cyberspace. And that middleman could track everything that you were doing. I mean, this is the reason that credit card bills are, financial transactions are frequently the first way that that fugitives are discovered. You know, they bought gas in this place at this time. And so it provides this perfect record that I think really scared the cypherpunks and this awareness that they could be tracked anywhere. And so they began imagining this digital cash that wouldn't be traceable. And they began experimenting with it. There were a bunch of these sort of ideas that were floated in the 1990s. There was one called BitGold. There was one called B-Money, RPAL. Actually, PayPal, I think, was very much in this line of thinking. PayPal initially was imagined much more ambitiously as a kind of money that wouldn't require a middleman, that people from any country could use. And it failed in those ambitions, just like all these other experiments I just mentioned failed. And Howe sort of kept going through this. His addition contribution to this was something called RPOW, reusable proofs of work, which didn't take off, I think, just because he called it RPOW. Even if it had been wildly successful technology, I'm not sure it would have worked with that name. But there was this sort of core group. A lot of people sort of gave up on the project. They felt like, this is impossible. We're never going to have that digital cash that anybody can move, can spend back and forth. But there was this small core of people, including Hal Finney, a couple other guys, a guy named Nick Szabo, that we may come back to, and some others, who kind of kept going with this. And it was Hal who was among the first people when Bitcoin was first announced in late 2008. Hal was one of the first people to respond and see that this Bitcoin idea might be exactly what they'd been looking to create back in the 1990s, this sort of digital cash. So the paper that Hal read was by a person named Satoshi Nakamoto. That was the name at the top of the paper describing Bitcoin. There was an email address. There were actually a couple email addresses, satoshi@gmx.com. There were some people who thought that Satoshi Nakamoto was a real person, of a young Japanese guy who had created this. But I think it became clear pretty quickly to a lot of people who were dealing with this that this was a pseudonym for somebody. Satoshi never spoke with anybody on the phone that we know of, and wouldn't even chat. Was just doing email, and so Satoshi is the one who described the system, and a few months later sent the software out. So this new system that he advertised could allow people to send money anonymously anywhere in the world. All the stuff I described at the beginning, with a Bitcoin address and a private key. So this was, in some sense, describing what the cypherpunks had been after, this notion of a digital cash. But I think it did away with more than just create a digital cash. It really did, for the first time, allow for a transaction that required no middlemen, and that required none of the banks that we need to do our current, all of our credit cards and financial transactions. And that notion was attractive at that moment to the cypherpunks, old guys, the privacy activists. But this was a few months after Lehman Brothers collapsed and the government bailed out the rest of the big banks. And so I think that this notion of a money that didn't rely on a bank or a central bank was very attractive in late 2008, when the central banks and Wall Street had sort of failed the country in some sense. And Satoshi also added another element to this digital cash idea, which was a sort of gold-like element to it. He harnessed the scarcity of gold, which has made gold so attractive over the years, this notion that there's only a limited quantity and you can sort of verify that you are holding gold. With Bitcoin, there were only going to be 21 million of them ever created, and they were going to be created in a very regular pattern. Every 10 minutes, a new block of them would be released, and nobody else would have a leg up in getting these new Bitcoins as they were released. Everybody who joined in the network could collect these new Bitcoins as they were released. And so it was a sort of very democratic promise that anybody joining in could get these new Bitcoins. This sort of idea of scarcity was actually the incentive that encouraged people to join in. The previous digital money, I think one of the big weaknesses was, how do you get people to believe that this is going to be worth something in 3 weeks or a month or a year? And this scarcity at least gave you some sense, okay, I'm getting something that there will only be a limited quantity of, and so, you know, there was a reason to think their value might increase. Unfortunately, for about a year and a half, the value did not increase. These things, as they were being generated, the system was working, new Bitcoins were being created, and they were worth essentially nothing. And the thing that hadn't been built in at the start was something to do with the Bitcoins. You could get them on your computer and have them sitting there on your ledger, as I was showing you earlier, in your wallet. But why would you want these things on your computer? You have dollars. They allow you to buy things on Amazon. That's very useful. What do you need this new creation for? There were a few sort of online marketplaces where people could sell the Bitcoins that they had mined, but almost nobody was willing to pay anything for them. So enter Ross Ulbricht, a guy who's been in the news recently. A kid from Texas, good-looking, adventurous, very smart, somebody who really, I think, had the world at his fingertips. In 2010, this was about a year and a half into Bitcoin's existence, he had recently dropped out of grad school from Penn State and was looking for a big project that would allow him to live up to his own potential that he imagined for himself, and he imagined a lot for himself. And he had grandiose visions of his own importance, but he also was a very sort of idealistic guy who was motivated by some of those ideas that came out of the cypherpunks, but also sort of ideas on the fringe of the libertarian world, the voluntarists and the agorists, who I think really earnestly believe that there's a moral imperative that people can transact freely, that there should be no limitations on what a person can enter into of their own free will, even when it comes to things like hard drugs. So he created the Silk Road, which I imagine most of you have heard about. It's a site that was like eBay, but for all the things that you can't get on eBay. And the key component of the Silk Road really was Bitcoin. There was another component which a lot of Bitcoin users used, including Satoshi, which was Tor, which is a kind of anonymous internet. But even if you had an anonymous internet, if you had previously tried to buy drugs online using PayPal or Visa, and the authorities caught onto it, all they had to do was subpoena PayPal or Visa, and they knew who you sent that money to, where you lived, everything about you. And so that kind of transaction was essentially impossible. And Ross, I think, to his credit, saw before anybody was really using Bitcoin in this way that Bitcoin could make it possible for a person in Washington State to send money to somebody in Amsterdam for heroin. And even if you could trace that transaction back to that ledger that I showed you earlier, all the cops would find was a jumble of letters and numbers. They wouldn't find your name. This was so Ross got this site going. It took a couple of months. His first step was getting a cabin outside Austin where he lived and growing like trash bags full of psychedelic mushrooms, so that he would have a product on day one. In February of 2011, or late January, he launched this. And it's kind of amazing. The day this project was announced on the Bitcoin forums, which is where people were communicating about this, the price of a Bitcoin doubled that day, went from 50 cents to a dollar. Within a few months, the Silk Road had a few hundred members. All of those trash bags full of psychedelic mushrooms had been sent off to people in various parts of the world. And the price of Bitcoins was shooting up. And, this was really, before the Silk Road came around, you could buy like some SpongeBob SquarePants stickers and some maybe server space from a sketchy dude somewhere, now you could get something of real value. And the price of Bitcoin went up very quickly in response to this. And one of the amazing parts of Ross's story is that, at least at the beginning, he wasn't actually particularly good at running this site. He was kind of constantly screwing it up. It was constantly going down under the load of people. It was coming under attack. He kind of enlisted a friend who ended up paying the price for having gotten enlisted in this project. But he was kind of doing this himself and just trying to make it work. And it was kind of a mess, but it was also actually working. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars were pretty quickly flowing through this network. And it was, again, this sort of massive global enterprise within months. And Ross, we only later learned that his name was Ross. He was running this for most of the time that the Silk Road existed under the pseudonym Dread Pirate Roberts, and was soon earning millions of dollars in commissions a month. And I think there is a tendency today, particularly in the Bitcoin community, to say that the Silk Road wasn't an important part of the Bitcoin story, or to want to kind of minimize it. And I think, you know, today this kind of illegal activity probably isn't that important to the network and the number of transactions happening in Bitcoin land. And I understand, obviously, people don't want to be associated with this, like, online, new legitimate businesses that are trying to use this don't want to be associated with this online drug bazaar illegal activity. But I think it is kind of important to understand that the Silk Road was, I think, very important to Bitcoin's history. It provided something that you could do with this new money, which wasn't possible before. And it really showed that it could work, that Bitcoin could do the thing it claimed to do. You could have a transaction and send money across the world. Nobody really was trying to do that in any serious way before Ross Ulbricht. And the Silk Road, over the course of 2 or 3 years, showed that Bitcoin could work. When Ross was finally arrested a few miles from here in October 2013 at the Glendale Public, Glen Park, thank you. I think it's notable, this is kind of often fudged in a lot of the accounts, it wasn't because of Bitcoin. It was actually because he left his email address on one of the public websites early on, and some law enforcement agent, after 3 years, was finally smart enough to search for his email address. That's a little bit of a simple telling of it, but it wasn't. They didn't trace him through Bitcoin to find him. They used a lot of other methods, and I think it's kind of telling that all his sort of Bitcoin addresses, you know, Bitcoin addresses don't have to be anonymous, but if you work hard at it, they can be anonymous. And Ross has basically managed to keep all of his Bitcoin addresses relatively anonymous to the end. And I think that's sort of important to understand. So the Silk Road showed it could work, but it won more attention than Bitcoin itself, and it gave Bitcoin this reputation there for a while as just sort of an online token for drug dealers. And that gave rise to a countercurrent of entrepreneurs who were looking carefully at Bitcoin and saw that the same qualities that made it useful for the Silk Road could also make it useful for a lot of other things, other legitimate businesses. And so I'm going to move to character who is, I think, at the center of this part of Bitcoin's history, Patrick Merck. Brian, you might want to just take a picture for his sake now. So this was a guy who I think probably wasn't the sort of person you'd anticipate being at the center of some new global movement. He was the child, actually, of government employees, grew up in Washington, D.C., was, you know, a lawyer who kind of moved around, ended up in Seattle, and kind of stumbled into Bitcoin, when he found Bitcoin, he was not seeing it as a way to sort of start new illegal markets or to overthrow central banks like a lot of the earlier people. He and some of the clients he began working with saw it sort of much more simply as a way you could make payments online that might be cheaper than the other ways to make payments online. He was a lawyer and he was a practical guy, and he knew that the rules of this whole world were very much up in the air and were probably going to be worked out on the fly. And he began trying to sort of figure that out and be that first person who figured out, understood the rules of engagement for Bitcoin. And so he was at the center of this thing that came together called the Bitcoin Foundation, that a big part of their mission was to provide an image for Bitcoin that was different than the Silk Road, sort of help portray it as something other than a currency for drug dealers. And in 2013, as the Silk Road was getting a lot of press, Patrick, who had a little kid, was flying back and forth from his home in Seattle to D.C. to lobby regulators and prosecutors and sort of teach them how Bitcoin worked and explain how it might be used for legitimate purposes, basically to provide cheaper transactions than Visa did or PayPal did, potentially make it easier to do the sorts of transactions that Western Union does. And there are actually a couple guys in this room who worked with Patrick and were in those hearings, were in those meetings with law enforcement. And this picture here is actually from a Senate hearing that Patrick was sort of instrumental in bringing together in late 2013, where many of the regulators and law enforcement people he had lobbied showed up and gave a remarkably positive take on Bitcoin. Up to this point in late 2013, there was this sense that the government might just come in and shut down Bitcoin. There wasn't a particularly clear sense of what that meant, how the government could shut it down. But that I know because I was a journalist writing about this, and I included that in many stories, also not being sure what exactly it meant. But it was kind of this requisite item in any story about Bitcoin up until this hearing that the government could just come in and shut it down. And after this hearing that Patrick pulled together, there was this sense, okay, even the government thinks this might be a legitimate technology. This might be something that can matter in the future. That really started to change things. So this was one current that was going on at this time. We've only a couple more people I want to talk about. At the same time that Patrick was selling lawmakers in Washington, this guy, Wences, was pitching a similar kind of legitimate but probably more ambitious vision for Bitcoin to the muckety-mucks out in Silicon Valley. Actually, Wences was one of the biggest surprises to me as I was researching this book. He was one of the people that maybe talked about the least. I mean, he's now, there's more written about him. He has a startup called Zappo. He's raised a lot of money. But I think his role in sort of convincing Silicon Valley that this was a technology that mattered is something that isn't necessarily fully appreciated. And his, I think, skill in selling Bitcoin to the big money here in the Valley was a result of his having grown up in Argentina, which has a financial system that is essentially all but broken. He made it to age 18 or 19, having created his first startup in Argentina. He never had a bank account. It was just kind of too hard to get bank accounts there. People didn't have credit cards. People just didn't have access to the financial system. And the other element that people are more familiar with is the sort of hyperinflation of the Argentine peso that's gone up and down. His family lost its wealth numerous times. And so he had a kind of he was coming from a different sort of more human place and thinking about what Bitcoin could do that he liked to always say that, you know, Americans didn't understand Bitcoin. I think he sort of spread this idea that America was not actually the place that Bitcoin was needed. It had sort of taken off in a place that had a currency and a financial system that worked pretty well. His vision was that it was likely, more likely to take off in places like Argentina, where people didn't have credit cards. And so the ability to just open a Bitcoin address and have money in it and spend that money online without needing to go through hundreds of pages of paperwork was really valuable. And he sold that vision to a lot of people at a lot of events that are now talked about. There was a heli-skiing trip out in Canada with these guys at the Fortress Investment Group, which is one of the biggest hedge fund private equity funds in New York, where he got them really excited. They didn't go public with it for a long time and haven't really still, but they, the guys who worked at Fortress, started buying up hundreds of thousands and then millions of dollars. He won over the president of PayPal, got him excited, got him buying lots of Bitcoin. And there was an event at this sort of this exclusive Allen & Company event in Arizona in early 2013, where he was kind of the talk of the town. And this was March 2013. And in the weeks after that event, the price of Bitcoin skyrocketed. We're now up in like $200 territory, back from a dollar when Ross Ulbricht found this. I don't think Ross Wences was the only reason that the price was going up then, but he got a lot of people to buy a lot of Bitcoin, and the price of Bitcoin is a pure function of the demand for it. And so when people were trying to buy $1 million worth of Bitcoin in a few days, they were pushing the price up very far. And as Wences was pushing this, and Silicon Valley, his Silicon Valley friends were starting to talk about this, he was coming into conflict with some of the banks that he'd worked with in the past, because a lot of the vision that Wences had was that Bitcoin was essentially a way to replace Wall Street. It was a way you could hold money. It was a way you could move money. It was a way you could do all kinds of new financial transactions. And he'd actually worked with JP Morgan Chase on all of his previous startups. When he tried to open a account with JP Morgan Chase for his new Bitcoin startup, they actually refused him and said, "We're not opening an account with you." Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of JP Morgan, has been pretty feisty, more feisty than most bank CEOs, in talking about Bitcoin, has sort of viewed it as, I think, more of a potential competitor to the banks. And at one point when Wences was asked, you know, what does Jamie Dimon think about Bitcoin, actually at a JP Morgan event, Wences famously said, "I think Jamie Dimon will have as much influence on the future of Bitcoin as the Postmaster General had on the future of the of email in the 1990s. I think finance is, I think that conflict between Wences and the financial world is really telling, because finance is a part of the world that, in a way, has not been remade by the internet, by this decentralization. The financial industry is essentially a bunch of middlemen who are sort of taking out cuts from every different sort of transaction. And, you know, it's unlike media that has been disintermediated, or communication, which has been disintermediated. So I think finance still very much is open to this sort of disintermediation and taking those middlemen out. But interestingly, I think the last step of this story that I want to talk about here tonight is the banks themselves. Because I think in the last year, a lot of the most interesting stuff that's been going on, or potentially momentous stuff, is coming from the big banks. And it was actually Wences, who has been in meetings with all, you know, JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, who have been getting won over by this idea as well. As you can imagine, the banks know better than anyone how hard and inefficient it can be to move money around the world. They're the ones who are having to deal with it. When they want to send money to another bank, they have to send messages to the Fed, and it can only be done on weekdays. One of the most famous examples of this during the financial crisis came when Morgan Stanley essentially got bailed out by a Japanese bank that offered Morgan Stanley, was going to offer them $9 billion to bail them out. But it was the weekend, and when they struck this deal, and it needed to be struck immediately, and so the systems that would normally be used to wire this $9 billion from the Japanese bank to Morgan Stanley weren't open. And as a result, the Japanese bank wrote, I think, what's thought to be the largest paper check ever to Morgan Stanley for the full $9 billion. And so, you know, the fact that two banks couldn't even send each other money at will, I think, is the sort of simplest explanation of where something might come in that allows for the instant transfer of money between two people. And so this has been going on within all of the banks. I think a lot of it is not on the surface. Some of it has surfaced recently. Goldman Sachs recently just made its first investment in a Bitcoin startup. But, you know, this has been going on for a year and a half now, that J.P. Morgan, despite all the sort of negative talk coming from Jamie Dimon, has had a 25-person Bitcoin working group that meets every 2 weeks and is coming from all the different divisions of the bank and is talking about how this might disrupt, you know, their credit card division, how it might disrupt their the more boring parts of the banking industry that we never hear about but are actually where all the money is made. One of the most ambitious efforts in this vein talked about recently is now being headed by a former J.P. Morgan executive named Blythe Masters. Her most famous role in history is as having created essentially having invented the credit default swap that created such problems during the financial crisis. So she, which drove her out of J.P. Morgan in large part. She has recently resurfaced as the head of a company called Digital Asset Holdings, and they're still kind of, I think, trying to figure out exactly what they're going to be doing, but the vision is that Bitcoin can be used to sort of, when a stock trade is made, currently it takes 3 days for a basic stock trade with the New York Stock Exchange to settle. The vision is you can use Bitcoin to basically instantly settle trades like that with Bitcoin, with other assets as well. So this is going on along with Wentz is still going along. Well, Ross Ulbricht on Friday was sentenced to life in prison, but Patrick Merck is still very much sort of in the mix here. This has obviously traveled a long way from Hal Finney to you know, a sort of money that was simply trying to address privacy concerns to something that Blythe Masters is trying to figure out. I think one thing it generally hasn't done is reached ordinary people. This is still very much a niche technology. Just one last thing I think that's worth understanding, because it helps explain, I think, why this hasn't gone out into the wider world, and that is the several disasters that have struck Bitcoin over the years, the biggest of which was thanks to this wonderful man, Mark Karpeles, who was the CEO of Mt. Gox, which was the largest Bitcoin exchange for most of Bitcoin's existence. It went down. This was, I think, when he was declaring bankruptcy or around that time last year, with something like $500 million worth of Bitcoins, its customers' Bitcoins. And amazingly, I think maybe Mark doesn't even know whether they were stolen or lost, these $500 million, there are a lot of search teams out there looking for them, but they essentially have not been discovered. I think it's often said by sort of Bitcoin fans that Mt. Gox didn't show any weakness with Bitcoin. Mt. Gox was, in some sense, it was just like an old-fashioned bank. They took people's money, they held your Bitcoins, it was this centralized company, and it went down, and so it took everybody's money with it. That's kind of what Bitcoin was invented to move away from. I do think that kind of explanation is actually a little simplistic. Mt. Gox existed and took everybody's money because it lived in a decentralized world in which there was no central authority looking over it. So anybody could survive, the good, the bad, the ugly, and they held They had gone through many problems which you would have think would have led them to go out of business in the past, but there was nobody there to push them out of business, just the market. And the market didn't push Mt. Gox out of business. People didn't take their money away from it. They kept going back to Mt. Gox. And so I think this is, you know, Mt. Gox was one of the dangers that exists when you exist in a world without any sort of central authority. And it may not have been a problem with the Bitcoin software per se, but it points to some of the issues that come up with Bitcoin and that are very important to understand when talking about it. So I think actually, though, in the end, one of the most remarkable things about the collapse of Mt. Gox is that it didn't do in Bitcoin. It did a number on Bitcoin. The price has gone down about 75% since Mt. Gox collapsed, and it sort of lingered down there. But I think one of the reasons it didn't collapse is this kind of story that I've told you tonight. And that is the fact that there are a lot of people trying to use Bitcoin for a lot of different reasons. And I think in the end, that's kind of why Bitcoin matters. It's not one thing. There is a sort of very valuable concept at the bottom of this. People just transacting directly with other people in cyberspace. But that has all sorts of implications. Illegal markets, Wall Street, basic transactions, credit cards, and things I should mention far beyond that, like voting and recording, recording other sorts of things that don't have to do with money in that sort of database that I showed you at the beginning. And I think it's that element of people working in all these different directions that has allowed this to survive. And I think that's in part because of the anonymity, the continuing anonymity of Satoshi Nakamoto. There hasn't been a person there to define it. And so it can be lots of things to lots of people. And that has turned out to be a real strength. We can talk more about Satoshi and the questions if we want to. This is still very much a technology that that has not been defined, and you know the price. People ask me frequently. The price appears to have stabilized recently. It's floating around $240, but this is still very much a sort of as an investment. People are buying Bitcoin based on their future vision of what this might be, and that is still very much a speculative matter because it is not solidly anything yet. It is still something that is in the works. No vision has, I think, really won out, and everyone is still guessing. But in the meantime, it's a fun story to watch, and I hope you'll get some flavor for that here. And I'd love to take some questions, because I'm sure there are people who are smarter about all this than I am in this audience.
Our thanks to Nathaniel for his discussion of digital gold and the inside story of misfits millionaires trying to reinvent money. We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. I will now open the floor to about 10 minutes of questions. Please keep your questions and keep them short so everyone has we can get as many of you as possible. Please raise your hand and speak into the microphone when you're provided.
Hey, so on the topic of government acceptance of Bitcoin, you talked a little bit about it. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the recent chartering of ITBIT by the New York Department of Financial Services and what impact you think that has and just overall what role the exchanges will play in this, what your thoughts are on that.
Right. So. Basically, ITBIT is this exchange that is very well connected politically, raised a lot of money, and they got what is sort of viewed as the first sort of charter to be a Bitcoin exchange. There are lots of other Bitcoin exchanges that exist, but a lot of them are existing in somewhat hazy legal territory. As I said, there are probably people in the room who could answer this question better than I could. I think there is a sense that if it is going to move in the Wall Street direction, in the institutional direction, it's going to need to have that sort of imprimatur. And Bitcoin exchanges are, it seems like in the end, Bitcoin exchanges kind of, like, if you're trying to move to a new kind of money, why do you want to be able to move in and out of them? And so I think the pure vision of Bitcoin is that everybody's sort of using Bitcoin, and they get Bitcoins and they spend Bitcoins and they never go back to the other dollars. I think that was something that that's really the stumbling block of Bitcoin, is that you don't get to that point quickly. And in the meantime, you have to coexist, and so you have to move in and out of dollars. And that's really been where I think all of the problems with Bitcoin have existed. If Bitcoin did exist as a sort of pure system, it probably would have functioned a lot better than it has. But it is having to coexist that has created all the problems. But I think people do, if we're going to move to an economy where people use Bitcoin, they're going to have to sort of get rid of their dollars in the meantime. And so businesses like this are going to have to exist. There's going to be have to be a way to actually acquire Bitcoins. And so that's necessary to grow quickly in the way that people imagine it. I think it could grow much more slowly in other ways without having those sorts of businesses. But that would be a very slow evolution. So getting the blessing of regulators and functioning in the United States, you know, to scale quickly seems necessary. And so I think you're going to see a lot more of that, of the big Bitcoin companies around trying to get that sort of approval. But I'm sure that's a topic to bring up in conversation with some of the folks around here.
Yes, my question's about the total number of Bitcoins. Like, the government, the Treasury, just prints more dollars.
Right.
How can you possibly guarantee that somebody's not out there making their own Bitcoins?
Essentially, that public ledger is where everything is kept track of. And basically, one of the rules to participate in that ledger is that you agree to this set of rules. Among those rules are only 21 million Bitcoins will be created. They will only be created every 10 minutes or so. It will be, for right now, 25 Bitcoins that will be released every 10 minutes. And they'll be released in this very particular way that's very confusing that I could not explain on a stage, but it's worth understanding at some point if you really want to get this. But so there's all these rules, and everybody is keeping track of this database. And basically, if you start following your own rules and adding things to that database that everybody else doesn't agree with, everybody just ignores you. And so you may be making Bitcoins, but they're Bitcoins that only you believe exist. And they're only worth something if other people think that they exist. And so that's the decentralized notion, is that you kind of have to get everybody to think that the thing you're doing is also the same thing that they're doing. And those rules are 21 million. Now, everybody could agree jointly that we're going to double that and we're going to make 42 million Bitcoins. And that could happen in the future. It would be very difficult. Much smaller changes than that have caused much greater difficulty in the Bitcoin world. But that's essentially the process there. Wikipedia. We have one up here.
Everybody, it's open input. Which is what Wikipedia is. So it's a form of Wikipedia in money.
Wikipedia is one of the many metaphors I try to use when explaining this. But Wikipedia, you don't send things with Wikipedia, and things aren't. But yeah, that notion that everybody's kind of creating this thing that they all use and that's updated communally is very similar to Wikipedia. Although the ways in which it's done, get into that up here.
You said Mt. Gox went under, right? What does that really mean? Because if all the Bitcoins are open and everybody knows about them, what became of all those Bitcoins that were lived in Mt. Gox?
That's a very good question, which I thought would be easier to answer. And I think a lot of people thought it would be easier to answer when Mt. Gox went under. Essentially, you can look at all of Mt. Gox's old addresses and see, okay, this there was an address, for instance, that we knew back in 2011 had something like 430,000 bitcoins in it. You can look at that address and see, okay, that money eventually went over this address. But eventually you get to an address where you don't know who it is or why it's there. Was that Mt. Gox's address or somebody else's address? So you know which address it belongs to, but that's actually not that helpful if you don't have an identity attached to it. Is it still at that point belonging to Mt. Gox, or is that at this point had Mt. Gox already lost it? And so there are, again, as I said, these sort of very ambitious investigations going on, some of which have given a preliminary sense of where the money may have gone and that it may have been some sort of inside job at Mt. Gox. But in some ways, it's an indication of how untraceable bitcoins are. Yes, you can see what happens, but that's not necessarily that useful, it turns out, in many cases, as law enforcement found out when they were trying to track down Ross Ulbricht.
So I'm old enough to remember when the U.S. dollar was actually silver certificates and gold certificates, and I get that that's a long time ago. But it's still, the Federal Reserve notes are still backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, and the rules we may not agree with, but who makes the rules on the Bitcoin thing, and what is to prevent it to just go south? I mean, it just sounds like it's not regulated at all, and what kind of prevention?
Essentially, the Bitcoin soft protocol, the Bitcoin software, is a set of rules about how this thing functions. And so far, those rules have kind of worked. Like, everybody has stuck to those rules. We are still on course to 21 million Bitcoins being released in the year 2140. It's being released at the pace people expected. There have been little hitches here and there, but essentially those rules are what everybody's following. And as I mentioned earlier, if you stop following those rules, you're kind of out of the system. Everybody ignores you. Now, that's kind of one set of issues. There's another set of issues of how do we know that people are going to value the things that are kept track of on this ledger for anything? And we don't. And the price has gone south many times. The price has gone south for most of the last year and a half. Went from $1,200 to $250. And it's still a very speculative thing. What it's backed by is the notion that people will use it someday. That's when you're buying Bitcoins, you're essentially betting that somebody is going to have use for this Bitcoin to do something with it in the future. And, you know, this gives you some sense of what people might do with it in the future. And so if you think they're going to do that in the future and they're going to do it more than they're doing it now, then you might think that Bitcoins will be worth more than they are now. But there's nothing saying that your ownership of a Bitcoin is going to be worth anything in a year's time. It's just, you know, again, one metaphor I've been using recently, and I don't know if this makes it any more helpful. This is a medium of transaction, of sending things around. You can hold the information, the Bitcoin, but then you can send it. And in that sense, it's maybe less like email than like sort of radio bandwidth. There's a limited amount of radio bandwidth, so if you want to send things around, you need to control that bandwidth while you're sending it. And so maybe if you think that bandwidth is going to be useful in the future, you'll buy some of it, which has obviously happened in the digital world. People have bought up all of the sort of digital spectrum. And, again, it's a way to move information. In this case, the information is money, how much money somebody owns. But they could all be worth $0 tomorrow.
We have time for one more question.
Thank you. My question's sort of similar to the question that was asked earlier about there being a set amount of Bitcoins, but it's sort of the opposite. What happens if there's Bitcoins lost, like in the Mt. Gox situation, but big chunks leave? What sort of remedy is there for the economy of Bitcoin?
None? I mean, there have been experiments, I think, that have been proposed, which none of which I know of in great enough depth to tell you about, but sort of creating like pseudo, but essentially when you've lost a Bitcoin, it is gone. And so there is a sense that in the end, there's going to be less than 21 million Bitcoins because a lot of them are sort of, you know, a lot of people early on when this was worth nothing, you know, got them on their computers. He did, for instance. I'm sure there are, I mean, you know, there's a famous story, a guy who, I'm talking with at an event later this week, a guy who has Stefan Thomas, who has something like $27 million worth of Bitcoin on like a hard drive that he can't remember the password for, and he keeps, he has like five guesses to, it's a, what's it called, an iron, what's the, there's it, there's somebody here knows the name, but it's a, you once you've done the five passwords, it freezes and you're done. And he's already tried like three of them, so he has two left. And there's a lot of money on there. But if he doesn't remember those other two, those are lost to the Bitcoin world. Somebody's got to like expose me for the cryptographic fraud that I am before I leave here. Nobody in the back wants one last shot at me? Yes, thank you. Oh. Okay.
Necessarily, but it's about your Overstock.com transaction.
Yeah.
They accept Bitcoin. They accepted your Bitcoin. Overstock had to get the book to your home, correct?
Right.
Who accepted Bitcoin from Overstock to pay for the delivery to your home?
But Overstock, this makes everything, like it gets a little more complicated when you try to understand real-world Bitcoin use. Essentially, Overstock immediately converts most of its bitcoins into dollars. It actually doesn't convert all of them because Patrick Byrne likes Bitcoin and he wants his company to have some. And so he's holding on. But most companies that you see out there that accept Bitcoin, what they do is they accept it. Rather than using Visa, the money comes to them via Bitcoin, and a company like Coinbase, which is based probably less than a mile from here, turns it immediately into dollars and sends that to their bank account and charges them a little bit less than Visa or Amex does to do that. So for Overstock, it's actually a great deal. For me, it's actually kind of not a great deal, and that's, I think, one of the reasons that people haven't, you know, used Bitcoin for online transactions. Credit cards work pretty well for most online transactions. Again, this is kind of the, like, the United States, Bitcoin, you know, in the simplest sense, this is not the place that Bitcoin is most needed. It's needed in places where people can't do basic online transactions, where their currency doesn't work. And so, you know, it's not like there was some, I got some great benefit from using my Bitcoin to buy my book. In fact, I just did that so that I could show you that I did it, and I actually voided that transaction as soon as it was done. Because I didn't want another copy of my book.
Our thanks to Nathaniel Popper. We also thank our audience as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.